This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Rithula Shah with your weekly deep dive into a story that's making news and changing lives. And this week we head to Lebanon.
أنا مش كافر بس الجوع كافر.
I am not an infidel. Hunger is the infidel. The words of an iconic Lebanese song which dates back to the Civil War. But it feels all too familiar to a country that is on the brink of economic collapse. Days ago, a 61-year-old man took his life on a busy Beirut street. Nearby, he left a banner quoting those lyrics, a tragic and very public demonstration of the desperation that's gripping the country. A government loan default in March saw the Lebanese pound plunge in value and pushed many ordinary citizens into poverty.
The gap between the rich and the poor has increased. Middle class is almost disappearing. We either have people who have luxuries or people who can barely afford to eat.
Those who can are exchanging their possessions for food, and other Lebanese are simply packing their bags and leaving.
I've been living here for 10 years and now we're leaving back to Australia. It's crazy. We couldn't even find dollars to exchange the money to travel.
Protesters blame a corrupt economic system that has enriched the elites. Is a country that's long been riven by sectarian divides facing its most severe challenge since the Civil War. With coronavirus adding to the pressure, can the people trust the government to help them?
When the coronavirus started, the government asked all the people to close their doors, to close their jobs, to close everything, their businesses, and let the people sit at home. The government didn't have a plan B for the people.
So, we're entering into the vortex of an accelerating crisis in Lebanon. Let's meet the panel who'll help us to negotiate the powerful forces that are pulling at the country. Freddy Baz is a Lebanese economist and a former board member at one of Lebanon's largest banks. Freddy Baz, when you think about the poverty and the suffering your country's faced in recent months, what's the image or the story that's resonated for you about the scale of the crisis?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Rithula. Honestly, I mean, I'm not surprised because this is an explosive combination of economic, financial, monetary and banking crisis. And wherever they happened, they generated serious socioeconomic and financial consequences. In Lebanon, okay, it's even more harmful because it's happening in the context of negative growth, rising unemployment and cost of living, major income inequalities and very poor social safety net.
So people are suffering. Henri Chaoul is the managing partner and founder of the financial advisory company Levantine Partners, and he was a negotiator on behalf of the Lebanese government with the IMF until he resigned 2 weeks ago. Henri Chaoul, Lebanon is facing poverty and suffering. Freddy Baz has begun to tell us about some of the things that lie behind that, and we'll definitely be talking about those during the course of this programme. But is there a personal story, an image that has really hit home for you that illustrates the scale of the crisis?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me. Let me give you a couple of statistics, and then I'll give you an example. So 50% of the Lebanese population is below the poverty line, and half of those, i.e. 25% of the people of Lebanon, are below the extreme poverty line. That's the type of statistic that is give you a sticker shock. As an example, I was sitting in a nice neighborhood of Beirut about a week ago or 10 days ago with a friend having a coffee in the morning, and here comes a middle-aged woman, clearly from a middle class, well-dressed, and she had a piece of paper on it, which was written on it, "I'm hungry," in French. And she approaches the table, would put the piece of paper on the table and stand out for a meter and wait for people to hand money. So this is unfortunately where we're starting to see that poverty is hitting all kinds of classes, is hitting all kinds of neighborhoods.
Sybil Risk is Director of Public Policies at Kuluna Irada, a civic organisation for political reform in Lebanon, and she's also the Lebanon correspondent for the French newspaper Le Figaro. Sybil Risk, amid this economic crisis, what has struck you, what story or image has illustrated the depth of the crisis for you?
Hello, and thank you for having me. I think what is the most striking is the state of shock in which many Lebanese are, and across the board. We all have stories of people who are, it's not exaggerated to say, in despair. I have lots of stories. One of them is a man that I met only once in my life, and he got my number and he asked me for help, anything, only to buy a medicine for his father and to help him pay his rent. Another story is another middle-class person who has had all her savings in a bank account and is just not able to understand that her saving has just disappeared. The state of shock is so high that the denial is still there, because it's very difficult to accept not only that the poor are getting poorer, but also a big chunk of the population, the so-called middle class, that has become poor from one day to the other.
And that banking crisis is central to what we're going to talk about. Sami Halabi is Director of Policy at Triangle Research Consultancy in Beirut. Sami Halabi, what have you seen or heard that illustrates the depth of this very human crisis in the country?
Thank you, Ridla. I mean, we've heard, as my co-panelists have said, we've heard many stories all across the class spectrum of Lebanon. I think one that really stuck with me actually was somebody who spoke to me. He's an economist. He's a friend of mine. We went to college together many, many years ago. He married another friend of mine. And when I asked him to do a job for us, he said, look, I'd love to help you, but I really just don't care anymore. I've given up all faith in there being any possibility of reform, and I just want my immigration papers, and I want to go to Canada, and I don't want to think about these things anymore. And this is someone who's an economist at one of the international agencies in Lebanon. He has a master's degree, he's well qualified, and this is where people are, really. I think what we're experiencing now is Lebanon's great correction.
We've had a glimpse then of the difficulties the country faces right now. There are several crises, all interconnected, financial, political, and banking. Sami, just to pick up from where you were there, just want to stay with ordinary people for a moment. I think it was Henri that explained that the sheer numbers that have been driven into poverty by the crisis that's unfolding. But if I have a job in Lebanon, how much has my income's value gone down? Just to illustrate how little money is worth compared to what it was worth.
I mean, right now, the Lebanese lira is trading around 70 to 90% lower than it was before the crisis. I think what Henri was mentioning was the 50% number. That's up from 30% before the World Bank, the IMF, the latest estimates. What you really need to understand is there's a difference between people who are paid in what the Lebanese have come to call fresh money, which is foreign currency that comes from outside the country, and people who are paid in lollars, which is the Lebanese dollar, which is what we call it now. And that is something that you can only use in Lebanon, and is valued at the old exchange rate. And this dichotomy between the exchange rate that's available on the street and what the value of the Lebanese lira, the local currency, actually is, and what people are actually getting in their banks and on screens at the bank and not in their hands as real money, is very different. And this is that gulf, that 70-80% gulf, is what you need to think of when you think of the standard of living that has just plummeted to the floor.
If you want to have an idea, the minimum wage was worth $450, and now it has been divided by approximately 6. Now the minimum wage is $75-77. And most of the Lebanese people owe their wage in Lebanese pounds, and this their purchasing power has been just divided by 6. But the most important thing is that very few Lebanese are left with jobs. Unfortunately, we don't have statistics because one of the particularities of this country is that it has been governed with no statistics at all and no job, no unemployment statistics. And the adjustment of unemployment has been done through immigration. So more than 40,000 young people would each year come on the labor market and find no jobs and they would emigrate. So since the end of the war, we have more than 1 million Lebanese who have fled out of the country because they could not find jobs. And this, of course, will be aggravated now with the crisis.
You've begun to paint this picture of what people are facing. Here's another really concrete example. There's been a striking increase in the number and kind of people who are actually now looking for food help. Let's hear from Soha Zaita. She's the executive manager at the Lebanese Food Bank.
We have a problem in the banks. We cannot retrieve the donations we are getting from Lebanon. But we are able to receive the money donated from outside Lebanon. It's fresh money, so we can use them as fresh dollars. The banks has locked the accounts of a lot of people, so they cannot retrieve anything. We are facing also a problem that the prices of the goods are getting very expensive. We usually distribute food boxes with $20 equal to 37,500 Lebanese liras. Now the $20 is equal to times 10. Usually a lot of people come in and knock our door. Yani they don't have that much money. They are not educated. A later stage, we started receiving phone calls. Today, I'm receiving emails from graduate students or parents with a great background. They don't have any job. No one from their families are working. The kind of people have changed. The load is very big. The demand is very high. When the coronavirus started, the government asked all the people to close their doors, to close their jobs, to close everything, their businesses, and let the people sit at home. So here in Lebanon, the government didn't have a plan B for the people. So till where we are going, what is heading in the future, nobody knows. But the thing we know is getting worse.
So, Freddie, I think we have really got a sense of what people are facing. In the longer term, isn't the biggest fear the fact that people are just willing to pack their bags and go? That sort of brain drain that Lebanon is experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, to put things in perspective, Ritula, if I may, the Lebanese economy is a consumer and importing economy. Household consumption represents 88% of GDP, and on average, imports cover 50% of household consumption. We have witnessed over the last several years a food balance deficit of $3 billion a year. Can you imagine with all the advantage, I mean, we have in Lebanon in terms of geography, geology, and human potential, we have a recurrent deficit in our food balance by $3 billion, which represent almost 17% of our overall trade deficit year after year.
So you're spending money importing food.
We import for $400 million every year of dairy products from Saudi Arabia. Can you believe it? So under those circumstances, all what has been said by my colleagues is not really surprising because there is very little monetary and fiscal space in Lebanon for the central bank and the government to intervene and support. And we are facing a major foreign currency liquidity crisis in order to ensure the basic supplies, you know, for the country in terms of basic food, oil, medicines, wheat, and so ever. I'm very pessimistic with respect to the short term.
Henri, we've talked about this a little bit in class terms, but obviously a really important part of understanding Lebanon is to understand that there are sectarian and religious divides. Is this crisis affecting everybody equally across those divides?
Poverty has no confession, right? So this is hitting literally everyone. It's hitting every community. It's hitting every religion. It's hitting every region. But I want to go back to one point about this cost of immigration. Poverty, we can see it. We can measure it. We can deal with it. And hopefully it will be a short-term phenomenon that we have to accept and that we have to cure. The real problem with immigration at this point in time is going to be the youth. These are the guys who are going to build the future of the country. And these guys are going to go and wait until the airports fully open everywhere in the world. And you will see a mass immigration of people that are the future of this country. And I am not sure how to measure that. I am not sure. It's just not in the number of people, but it's going to be also in the quality of the people. But the idea today is how to manage this and what is the social contract, what is the type of society we want in the future. And unfortunately, if the youth are going to be gone from this country, they are going to be a very important element and determinant of what future they want.
Let's look back for a moment, actually, before we begin to think about that future, because Lebanon's a tiny country that's often found itself at the epicentre of Middle Eastern conflicts. Its borders with Syria and Israel and its mosaic of communities and religions have often turned it into a cauldron for regional tensions. Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, Christians and Druze, they're the main population groups in a country that, in a sense, has been a refuge for the region's minorities for centuries. Historically, power has been shared among the different religions and communities, but there was, of course, a civil war that raged from 1975 to 1991. This is a BBC report from Beirut at the height of the conflict in 1989. The Christian leader, General Michel Aoun, who's now Lebanon's president, then demanded that Syria withdraw all its troops from the country.
Quite indiscriminate, and as ever in Lebanon, civilians bore the brunt of the continuing madness. As shells poured into Muslim West Beirut from the Christian East, the population was trapped in the rush hour crowded streets. A school bus was one of dozens of vehicles hit, and several children were killed. The battleground covers most of the Lebanese capital, in what, in reality, is a country that has no government, is ungovernable, and is rapidly disintegrating. Syria's so-called peacekeeping force is now directly involved in the fighting, and the Christian leader says, ominously, the battle to liberate Lebanon has begun.
Well, in the end, General Aoun gave up and fled. An uneasy stalemate followed with an agreement in the city of Taif in Saudi Arabia, which brought a formal end to the civil war. But Lebanon's internal politics have remained strained, and the neighbours, Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Israel, they've all exerted their influence, or meddled, depending on your point of view, in the country's affairs. Sybil, if we look back, how important do you think those events and the structures that flowed from them underpin the kind of crisis we're seeing in the banking sector now?
Look, I think the real issue is a political issue. We are now, this year, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the creation of the state of Lebanon. But in reality, until now, we don't have a state as Lebanese. And we are facing the fact that we are a failed state. So beyond economics, and however difficult the times are, the major issue is the fact that we don't have a pilot, we don't have a captain on board. The plane is crashing, and the pilots, because there is not one pilot, but there are several, 6 to 7 sectarian leaders whose only concern is to look for their own parachute. They don't care about the Lebanese people and their fate. They only care about their own situation. This is because we don't have a state. The function of a state and of a government is to care for the people. We don't have that. So the main issue is to challenge our political class in order to have a real state institution and not facade of a democratic system.
Sami, if I can bring you in, do you agree that, in a sense, there is an absence of a state? And in the absence of the state, did the banking sector come to dominate?
One of the main things to note here is that there is an economic crisis, but at the same time, there is a revolution in the way people are thinking and conceptualizing their state and who they are and what their relationship to that state is. I mean, Henri mentioned the social contract. We need to become citizens. Citizens have rights and responsibilities. And if we do that, we can overcome this crisis. and we can even thrive. I mean, everybody, especially the Lebanese, knows how much potential we have. But if we continue to point fingers, maintain affiliation to sect and not state, this crisis will devour us, and we will become impoverished, and we will be returned to civil strife.
But for the purposes of our audience, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, the sort of this current crisis, this immediate crisis, is about a crisis in the banking sector. And to what extent, I guess, are banking and politics linked? And how did the banking sector, if you like, come to dominate?
I'd like to call it a regulated Ponzi scheme built by politicians, commercial banks, and the central bank. And the regulated word is key here. Nothing was done illegally. The banks profited and peddled disgustingly high interest rates to attract foreign currency. Politicians borrowed to fund the patronage state and maintain power. People also borrowed at low interest rates, had high interest rates for savings. The central bank set up the system to allow the government not to do its job and the banks to profit. What you have to understand here is that there's a huge conflict of interest between all of these parties. I mean, half the assets in the country are in banks owned by persons who are either members of previous cabinets or parliaments or directly related to them. There's no accountability. There's no rules. There's no conflict of interest legislation. There's no antitrust legislation. The taxation system is completely flawed and regressive. You're thinking, think about a country that has a top tax rate of around 25%. Now it's time to pay the piper. No one wants to take responsibility, and everybody wants to point fingers at each other. People are footing the bill at the end of the day because they're trying to take their money out, and they can't do it.
Freddie, very briefly, and we'll have to take a break, and I will allow this conversation to continue, but Freddie, do you accept that characterization of the banking sector in Lebanon?
No, not really. First of all, I don't like the appellation of dominant banks. By definition, banks, you know, create money. And this is a power by itself, I mean. But not to the extent of imposing whatsoever, you know, policies in the country. When you look, you know, at figures and numbers, and you see the corruption and the waste, plus, you know, all kind of tax evasions, how much they have represented over the last 30 years in terms of foreign income. We are talking about close to $150 billion. This is very material with respect to whatever over risk appetite the bank have shown over the last, you know, several years, because there have been definitely a problem of risk governance at the level of bank management. But this is not the main reason of what happened.
Okay.
In the chain of responsibilities, we have to start, you know, addressing politicians, which have been responsible for designing budgets and voting on budgets and signing on budgets. And therefore, you have the central bank, which have defined monetary policies accommodating more distorted financial policies instead of comprehensive economic policy. And lastly, you can address banks' responsibility in terms of what risk policies their board have agreed.
And just to remind you, you're listening to a podcast edition of The Real Story from the BBC World Service, this week looking at the crisis in Lebanon. Each week we tackle a different topic. Please subscribe so you can access the full library of programmes and subjects. Last week we asked if young people will bear the burden of the costs and consequences of COVID-19. And do please let us know what you think of this podcast from The Real Story. You can tweet me. I'm at Ritala. But now let's get back to this edition of The Real Story with me, Ritala Shah. We're joined by Freddie Baz, a senior Lebanese banker, by Henri Chaoul. He was a chief negotiator on behalf of the Lebanese government with the IMF until he resigned 2 weeks ago. Sybil Rizk is a journalist and campaigner for political reform in Lebanon. And Sami Halabi is from the Triangle Research Consultancy in Beirut. We talked a bit earlier in the programme about the human cost of this crisis. We've also begun to talk about what may lie behind it and what the solutions may be. Are they in the banking sector, or are they, in a sense, in the politics of the country? I wonder, Henri, if I can bring you in. We heard Freddie a few moments ago talking about the fact that he felt it was the politicians who had to really take responsibility. You were there negotiating with the IMF, trying to bring in a loan. Those negotiations, you walked away from them ultimately because you didn't think they were making progress. Where do you think responsibility lies?
Well, thank you, Ritala. I mean, actually, I have to side with Sami on this more than with Freddie. I do think that actually the Lebanese political landscape. I've been using a word over the last few weeks and months, actually, calling the Lebanese system as an incestuous bankocracy, because the financial system, the financial actors in the country and the politicians have overlapped, and they've been all doing the same thing. So it's right that the state, and Freddie is right about this, corruption started in the state. There's no doubt about it. There's overspending, there's waste, there's corruption, there's all you want, mismanagement. We can label it the way we want. But all that has been fueled, you know, by the banks that have not done their homework, that have taken the depositors' money and that have invested it in sub-investment grade securities and increased their exposure to a failed state, as Bill has said. So the responsibility lies, unfortunately, everywhere. And this is where it becomes very difficult to say, you know, how do we pay and who should finance the losses that exist in the system today? There's no doubt that the state is responsible in terms of ensuring stability of a financial system. There's no doubt that the state is responsible to smoothen the blow that everyone is going to get. But that doesn't mean that the financial actors in the country should not support also an equally important share of the burden. You look at the parliamentarian landscape. I mean, between the overlap between owners of banks being board members, being owning preferred shares in banks, is the overlap is huge. So I'm not sure that the parliamentarian, when they go and define and write policy and legislate, that they're really talking about the best interest of the population at large.
Freddie, there's just too much overlap between these sectors to be able to separate out, to say the bankers really come last in this queue. They are part of that political fabric.
Ritala, if you allow me, I believe that the incestuous relationship between the politician and the judiciary, which is supposed to be independent, have been much more harmful. Corrupt and incompetent politicians have to be sanctioned by the independent judiciary authority, which do exist.
Yeah.
The central bank governor, which is at the head of the monetary authorities, which is an independent authority, can be relieved of his functions by the Council of Ministers, as per the Article 19 of the banking law, in case of evidenced wrongdoing or major error in policies.
But Freddie, every country has lots of institutions and laws. But if you don't have
if it
doesn't function effectively, does it work? Does it matter? You can have the piece of paper that has the rule written on it, but if there isn't a clear separation, if you don't address conflicts of interest, can the rules work?
Yeah, I'm not trying to defend bankers. It do exist, and I'm not saying that it does not exist. But it's unfair to say that this is the main cause, you know, of the problem.
Can I make a small interjection here about the bank? I mean, I agree with what you're saying, Mr. Baz. If we're going to sit here and assign a hierarchy of responsibility, we will never end this conversation. I think it's not really productive to do that. What we need to understand is, you know, let's take today. The banks are imposing blatantly and illegal, arbitrary capital controls on people's money. If there was a law from the government saying that there are capital controls in place, we're going to stop any capital flight and we're going to deal with this situation, that would be a serious step by the government. The government doesn't do that. And the banks don't care. The banks are not worried about the judiciary coming in and prosecuting them. And so that is a sign of how rigged the system is and how interconnected it is. And that's why I think that we have to think about the commercial banks and the government and the central bank as not as separate entities. And of course, you are right. The banks are supposed to increase the wealth of their shareholders. That is their primary objective as banks. And the central bank is supposed to regulate them. The thing is that Lebanon, and this is emblematic of the Lebanese social contract, there's no accountability, there are no rules, there's no responsibility. And therefore, everything is free-for-all. And we have to stop this. And this is what I think the Lebanese are finally waking up to, and the politicians are incapable of doing any of this because the judiciary, the central bank, and the commercial banks are all so intertwined that in order to unbundle them is unbundling a system that has been in place since the end of the Civil War and before, and even as Sibylle was saying, since the creation of this country 100 years ago.
It is fascinating to see how there are these connections and how there are these stresses. I just want to keep bringing it back to people, because I think it's easy to think of this as very theoretical. if we look at another symptom, in a sense, of Lebanon's problems with its economy, I mean, its cities are known for having these amazing shopping malls full of sort of big name, high end stores. But now, with money frozen in banks, as many of you have been alluding to, more and more people are actually turning to secondhand goods and they're bartering them. Lulia Halwani works for an organisation called Fabric Aid in Lebanon. Its aim is to collect unwanted clothes from wealthy areas, recycle them and sell them at a nominal price in poorer parts of the country. And she's been telling us about the changes she's been witnessing.
Something that's very important that changed is that the demand for secondhand clothing has increased. The amounts of sales that we are doing at the moment in retail at these micro prices has peaked. We've never done numbers like this before. And this is due to the need for people to buy secondhand clothing. They are not able to afford new clothing anymore. And the amount of people who are moving towards the direction of secondhand clothing has increased. Now, this creates another problem for us because the number of donations has also decreased because people who were doing better used to donate their clothes more because they used to buy new clothes every season. Now that the economic situation has worsened and new clothes have become really expensive, people are unable to buy new clothes every season, and so they are keeping their clothes at home. We can see that the gap between the rich and the poor has increased. Middle class is almost disappearing. You either have people who have luxuries or people who can barely afford to eat. So it is definitely getting worse, but we are hopeful because our vision is if the younger generation don't stay and try to fix things, even if our footprint is still small, I mean, what's the point? We want to stay here and fix here. So this is very important to us.
That's Lulia Halwani. Sybil, there was a large protest movement in October last year, and that's really when people began to sit up and realise that Lebanon had real difficulties. From our conversation, we've talked about the deep roots of some of these issues. But why do you think there is this crisis right now?
The major issue there is the lack of accountability. And when you want to play the blame game, everyone is playing the blame game and no one is taking responsibility for the major failure of the whole system. This is what's striking me. Everyone, Mr. Baz said it was not surprising. Of course, it's not surprising for someone who has followed the economic development. But now that we are facing a major failure, no one is taking responsibility.
But why do you think it's happened now? I mean, sitting here in London, you know, I've read reports of suicides in the street, of domestic workers being turned out onto the streets, left destitute of the sheer poverty and hunger. Why do you think it has come to that now?
Simply because Lebanon as a country, as an economy, has lived on debt. We attracted dollars to our economy by rewarding depositors with very attractive interest rates. But we forgot that we didn't produce anything. We didn't export anything. We don't have a productive economy. We were never being able to get these dollars back to their owners. The particularity of Lebanon is that this
There was a hole in the middle where there should have been real money.
It's a hole that is so big that even the IMF experts are amazed. It's a hole that is symptomized by a hole of $50 billion in the central bank itself, which is supposed to be the guarantee, the guarantor of the stability of the system, and who has maquillaged its own balance sheet to just not show the hole. It's a giant Ponzi scheme at the level of a state and a whole banking sector, and now that has been uncovered.
Freddie, Lebanon's banking system was one that was envied throughout the region. Do you think the sort of the tarnishing of that reputation in the midst of this crisis, is that something that disturbs you? Can it regain that reputation?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, the harm is very big. But very quickly, I mean, we have went through a similar crisis in the mid-80s. But I do agree with Sybil that probably the wrong turning point was when late Prime Minister Hariri decided to shift domestic debt from Lebanese pounds to US dollar. I don't agree with Sibyl that we should have assumed that we will never be able to reimburse those Eurobonds, because we would have built a different economic engine. We could have probably generated the required dollars, you know, to pay back those Eurobonds. Mm-hmm. But we failed in the economic model much more than, you know. But still, in order for the country to be able to shift to the Eurobonds, the central bank have implemented a peg. And this is what have exacerbated even more, you know, the problem.
I just really want to think about this a little bit more. I think, Henri, what Freddie's saying is that this country has been through bad times before, but you've come back. You were at those talks with the IMF. I mean, why is it so much worse this time? You walked away.
Well, Ritula, because this is actually, that links to what Sibyl was saying. It's the lack of accountability and the lack of transparency, I would say, is the story of Lebanon. It's the story of a failed state.
Who would have to relinquish sort of power and I imagine money if you were to move on from that?
Well, I mean, you have the big six, right, that run the country. We all know who they are. You know, I mean, we can go and name them. These are the six political leaders that run the country. They all have to relinquish power if we want to change the system. If we want to change the system, the financial sphere and the public sphere should not be overlapping. Today, the reason we are where we are is because we have a system that really doesn't care about its people. And it shows during those negotiations, as we were going through them, it was not clear to them that the reforms that were being asked by the international community, by the international organization, by the financial experts all over the place, were going to be that serious. And when they realized that actually those reforms that they have to do are really deep-rooted, they all ganged up together, the central bank, the banks, and the politicians, in order to boycott and to hijack the whole process. And today, I mean, look, at the last 2 weeks since I've resigned 3 weeks ago, but over the last 3 weeks, there has been what? Maybe three, four meetings with the IMF at the heart of an imploding economic and financial and social crisis. Three meetings. I mean, this is not serious. That's the reason why.
So you're saying there's no sense of urgency, in a sense, in the midst of the crisis?
Not at all.
I just wanted to really bring another illustration to the table. You mentioned the lack of perhaps social net. A clear, perhaps, indicator of this is the health system. Obviously, this crisis has come in the midst of the coronavirus outbreak. The health system in Lebanon is on the verge of essentially shutting down from a lack of funds. Let's just hear from Dr. Mustafa Alouche. He's a physician and he's actually a former MP too, from Saad Hariri's Future Movement, which is a Sunni Muslim grouping. He's based in Tripoli.
Now we are really in a real danger of closing a good number of private hospitals. The 90% of our medical management in Lebanon is based on private hospitals. And the vast majority of them are not able to pay for the medical supplies and for the regular expenses. This is why now Private Hospital Coalition in Lebanon have decided to stop accepting regular cases, and we're only accepting emergency life-saving cases. But if things do not change, then probably many of these hospitals will close, in addition to the regular cases, to the emergency cases.
But where would people go then if these hospitals close? I mean, what proportion of the healthcare sector are we talking about here?
We're talking about at least 90% of the healthcare sector. And definitely this means that people may die in the streets because of an appendix or a regular emergency. And this is not because the hospitals do not want to work. They all want to work. We all want to work. However, they are not able to get their medical supplies to give adequate service for the patients.
You were suggesting that 90% of hospitals in Lebanon could potentially close down. How quickly could that happen?
We're talking about 2 weeks ultimatum. The hospital coalitions have given the government 2 weeks ultimatum, telling them that if nothing changes over the next 2 weeks, if we don't get enough money, if we don't subsidize the medical supply that we have to get by foreign currency, then we will close completely except for cases of renal dialysis and chemotherapy for cancer. This is why, at least for the time being, we're seeing a disaster coming very fast.
That's Dr. Mustafa Alouche. Sami, clearly a crisis in health is one that affects citizens very directly. We've talked about the fact that you can't have a hierarchy of blame necessarily. That doesn't lead you towards solutions. But I wonder whether Lebanon is ever entirely in charge of its own destiny. I mean, to what extent does the fact that this is a country bordered by very powerful neighbours and at the centre of sort of regional conflicts, to what extent does that simply compound the crisis that Lebanon faces?
I mean, it is the underlying reality of the reality that we live in as Lebanese, but it is the result and the process of the sectarian system of Lebanon. I will pick out Hezbollah in this case because they are the most powerful political force in Lebanon and military force in Lebanon. Hezbollah does Iran's bidding. Other parties beholden to Saudi Arabia and the West do their bidding. Hezbollah pays monthly salaries, provides public services to hundreds of thousands of Lebanese. If the state did that, Hezbollah wouldn't be so powerful. And we also need Hezbollah when the Israelis come and they want to destroy the country with some backward Zionist bigotry or what have you. We're not getting rid of them. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the more we make power divisive in this way that is linked to sect and not to state and not a real political and economic transition towards something that is not zero accountability, that is not just conflict of interest, that is not oligopolistic markets up and down every single sector so that prices stay high and people stay poor, and you have this sort of fiefdom relationship, then we're going to continue pointing the blame towards the geopolitical situation and saying, okay, you know, it's because of the war, in Syria. It's because the Israelis bombed us in 2006. It's because of Hezbollah. It's because of Saudi Arabia. We're never going to get out of this if we don't take a look at ourselves. You have to think about Lebanon as a country. There, 70% of the wealth is owned by the top 10% of the people in the country.
But just to go back to something else you were talking about, the power of Hezbollah, given its place, it's seen as being backed by Iran, doesn't that essentially mean that actually other countries that might have perhaps come to Lebanon's aid simply won't do so now? So the US and the Gulf, there is no way that they'll come to Lebanon's aid right now? Or is that oversimplifying the situation?
It's a fair analysis, I think. But, you know, would they even want to? Do they even have the capacity? In the age of low oil prices, do the oil-rich Gulf states really want to help Lebanon out? Is this part of Donald Trump's maximum pressure campaign? It is. And, you know, we'll see a national unity government come in place. There'll be some compromises. Hezbollah knows how to compromise. The point is not this. The point is that Hezbollah and the other five major parties that are taking control of Lebanon and basically playing chicken with the population don't want to relinquish power and don't want to relinquish economic power, and they're losing credibility day by day. That is the silver lining to this big disaster.
So, Sybil, let's throw forward then. Let's look for a solution. Who do you think might take on this project of reform? Who might pay for it? Who might untangle it?
I think it has become clear that the inertia of the current political system is a result of the inability of the system itself to put in place reforms. So the real challenge now is to build an alternative political force. It's a really big challenge because, as you were saying, we are a country that has always been the theater of a war by proxies. And the wars are numerous, and they spread into Lebanon. So the real challenge is for the new generation to understand that the Lebanese must think their future together and not look for a helping hand from the exterior, because there's no such thing as an exterior helping hand with no interest.
It's so all help mm-hmm. comes with strings. Freddie, as we try to throw forward then, if there's going to be an internal solution, you're not going to look externally, if there's going to be political reform, won't the elites, won't those people who have made money from the way in which the country has been run, blame it on the banking system, blame it on the politics, whatever, won't they have to pay? And would they be willing to pay in order to make the country solvent again?
I mean, it's not about their own decisions, Ritula. I mean, if there is a mechanism and the processes to make them pay back, they need to pay back. But I mean, going back to your main question, Ritula, about what needs to be done immediately, because we are talking about 2 weeks ultimatum for hospitals. We are talking about people, you know, starving in the streets. In my opinion, reforms have been long awaited and they are urgent, and nobody is arguing about, you know, this priority. But we cannot wait, you know, for reforms in order to feed all these people and to provide, you know, the needed health services.
But that would deal with the immediate crisis, but wouldn't there need to be some kind of reckoning with this system and with the wealth that people have gained from this system with the processes in place? Do you think there is the willingness amongst those elites to do that?
Ritula, we need an urgent external financial assistance. We need also to do some political concessions in order to be able, beyond the IMF, to get financial assistance from the countries which have traditionally, you know, helped Lebanon, the GCC.
But Henri, if I can bring you in, if there is to be that kind of external help, it's going to involve some financial paying, what they call a haircut. Some people are going to have to take losses, aren't they?
Yes, of course. The IMF has been very clear, and I think they went publicly a number of times and said, look, the government diagnostic or the government plan, the diagnostic in the government plan is the right one. And the approach to the whole crisis is the right one. Now, a plan is a plan. At the end of the day, Freddie is right and Tammy is right. Freddie is right in the sense that we need yesterday, not tomorrow, external help, external dollars flowing back into the system. But at the same time, Sami is right in the sense that, well, I mean, the program that the international countries, the international support group, the IMF, and all these guys are saying is that the financial system, by and large, has to support the pain. And it's not going to be, you know, taxpayers' money or state assets that are going to fund the solution. Meanwhile, what we are seeing is bickering over this number and that number between the financial sector on one side and the politician on one side and the government on the other. So I'm not sure how to solve that, but clearly the political landscape is not prone to do reforms, because reforms means opening the books, and that is not something that they are comfortable with.
We're nearly out of time. I just want to quickly ask both Sami and Sybil, in October, when there were protests on the streets, there appeared to be hope. People appeared to be talking about ways to move forward. Do you think that hope has been extinguished? Is a deal possible? Sami, first.
I think a deal is very possible. I think we need to regain the confidence of the Lebanese and the international community. We need very quick measures, very quick capital controls, establish a baseline of fairness, a progressive haircut where the profiteers pay lowest and best conditions from the IMF. We need a political process where there are new elections. We move towards a non-sectarian state. We remove banking secrecy. We introduce conflict of interest legislation. And the Lebanese can build a better state where we focus on growth from productive sectors. We create local jobs. We increase self-sufficiency. And we reap the rewards of social solidarity. It is possible. And the only power only comes from the people. If the people are finally convinced that the political cabal, the political economic cabal that has ruled this country since its inception, has lost all credibility, then they will vanish and we will build something new.
Sybil, is a deal possible? Can hope return?
I think that when demonstrators went to the street in October, they were full of hope and that their movement, which was unprecedented, would lead somewhere. Now, if people don't go to the street anymore, it's because hope has vanished. Why? Because when you go to the street, you ask, you recognize the legitimacy of your institutions. Now, we don't recognize the legitimacy of the institutions. So why are we going to ask anything about a government that has proven that the authorities don't care about the fate of the country? So my main concern is that we will go into violence, because when you cannot, through demonstrations, through institution, have legitimate asks, what can you resort to except violence? This is my main concern. But I'm still optimistic that some people have understood what's at stake and will try to build the alternative that is needed to this failed state. It will take time, but I'm hopeful this will prevail, this attitude will prevail.
Well, that's a fascinating, slightly chilling thought to end with. That's it for this week on The Real Story. Thank you very much to all of our guests, Sybil Rizik, Sami Halabi, Henri Chaul and Freddie Baz. If you'd like to listen to the programme again or any other from the archive, you can listen back online by searching for BBC The Real Story. From me, Ritula Shah, and the whole team, that's The Real Story for this week. Thank you for listening.